Welcome to the Maintenance Mavericks podcast, where we talk about trends in maintenance, reliability, and asset operations. I'm Ryan. I'm the CEO and founder of Upkeep. And for today's guest, I'm super excited to welcome not one guest, but two guests here. We've got John Povilaitis and Alan Seltzer. John and Alan are shareholders in Buchanan Ingersoll and Rooney, which is a law firm where they assist clients in energy, utility, and renewables industries, as well as help with some big energy transactions. So welcome to the podcast, John and Alan. How are you guys doing today?
Well, fine. Thanks, Ryan. We really appreciate the opportunity to join you.
Great to be here with you.
All right. And likewise. So what we always do is start the show off by asking both of you guys how you're first introduced to this industry and what your journey has been like. Maybe we could start with John.
I started my legal career with the Pennsylvania Public Utility Commission right out of law school. And at the PUC, I was introduced to service quality issues, rate case issues, cases before the federal agencies that are physically kind of proximate to our headquarters in Harrisburg. And I got to, get involved in depth with the administrative litigation. Interestingly, one of my first rate matters was with Alan when he was a representative of General Public Utilities, GPU, and they had that little problem called the Three Mile Island accident. And that led to a series of very interesting and complicated PUC cases in which I represented the staff and Alan was representing GPU. Later, we ended up collaborating by being in the same law firm. And we're still practicing together today.
As John indicated, we've been together practicing law for many, many years together in the broadly defined energy and utility space. My trajectory has been a little bit different. I have spent my entire career since the late 1970s in private practice, and it has been really exclusively devoted to the energy and public utility area. I came out of law school in the late 1970s, managed to find a job with a law firm that was practicing public utility regulation. And I literally started out having no idea what a public utility was. And I started from the ground up learning the business. And of course, it sort of brought me to where we sit today, many years later. But as John indicated, within about 6 months after I started practicing as a young associate, we had the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island. And that literally to this day remains the largest single administrative law case that I have ever been involved in almost 44 years of practice. And it really catapulted my career in the energy and utility space because I got the opportunity through the early 1980s to develop and negotiate power supply contracts with then budding entrepreneurs that were not utilities called qualifying facilities to put on the first 15 or 20 long-term power purchase agreements in Pennsylvania to replace the lost power that resulted from the nuclear accident in Three Mile Island and not having that facility available. And that literally launched my, energy and public utility career and has expanded greatly since that time. And we'll get into some of that, I'm sure, during the course of our discussion today.
Yeah, we're here on the Maintenance Mavericks podcast. You guys have a wealth of information about, energy, utilities, and I would love to take a deep dive into this topic because really, what I heard recently is like energy is the currency of the global currency of the world, and it affects all of us. So maybe we could start with something very pressing. What's going on right now? So I think we all know that government, Congress recently passed this infrastructure bill, which is this big investment that really aims at ultimately modernizing the entire country's infrastructure. And we know that this bill has actually made big implications on the energy industry. So I want to kind of ask both of you guys, what do you think will be the long-term impact of this bill for the energy industry? Short-term, mid-term, long-term?
Ryan, I think it's a great question. And it's one that a lot of people are asking. And as you properly point out, this infrastructure bill is all about massive amounts of government spending over the next 15 to 20 years. And the bill is a $1.2 trillion infrastructure spend by the federal government by moving dollars from the federal government back to state and local governments and others to really focus on a few very, very key areas. I think before we get into sort of the specifics of the areas, I think the impacts of any sort of government spend bill are likely to be much longer term in terms of seeing the actual effect. The short-term effect of spending dollars, hopefully, is job creation and beginning to see a lot of activity in very specifically targeted areas of the energy sector. But I think the long-term implications, where hopefully the spend produces new infrastructure, improved infrastructure, modern types of things for the energy grid and the energy space, that, you know, we really can't even fully envision today. So at a high level, the $1.2 trillion bill, first and foremost, is targeted towards transmission grids in an infrastructure build out. And that really goes to the fact that we have an antiquated and old electric transmission grid system that moves power from generation to local load centers across the country. It's vulnerable to physical attacks, cyber attacks. It is not modern. It's all above ground. It's vulnerable to wind and hail and climate change issues. And the bill is targeting $65 billion of upgrades towards the transmission system to specifically make it more resilient, to make it more reliable, and to, most importantly, from what the work that John and I typically do with dealing with renewables, expanding renewable energy. So much of our renewable energy in this country, wind and solar, is located, you know, in areas that are very remote from load centers, and having adequate transmission to kind of get it to the load centers is critical. That spend is going to be will be fantastic. Long term, hopefully, it provides the kind of resiliency and reliability that we've really not seen in a long time. The second thing that the bill is really doing is really devoting a huge amount and a tremendous commitment to clean energy projects, which would be renewable wind, solar, and technologies like microgrids, geothermal, energy capture, advanced nuclear, things that kind of get us away from our historical dependence in the U.S. and globally on traditional fossil fuels to produce energy to power us. That's a sea change. We know climate change is huge. It's real. And hopefully this kind of $500 million spend on energy infrastructure demonstration projects to facilitate development of clean energy and renewable energy, will be, something that's great. Related to that is the bill addresses battery storage, which is a huge, huge issue in this country, because so much of the renewable energy we have is intermittent. It doesn't necessarily work all the time when the wind's not blowing, when the sun isn't shining. And battery storage is a game changer in terms of being able to provide the kind of reliability and resiliency benefits that that we're hoping to get out of the electric grid going forward. And basically, the law is looking to spend $6 billion in funding battery storage projects and grants over the next several years. And then the last one I wanted to talk about, because the bill is 1,000 pages or more, so there's massive amounts of stuff across the energy space as well as infrastructure generally, is just electric vehicle infrastructure. You know, you're out in California, we're in the East, and there's a vast difference between the build out we've seen thus far and the penetration of electric vehicles across the country. We don't have enough charging stations anywhere, but certainly in the East, electric vehicle sales are creeping up slowly. They're much bigger in California, where you are, in parts of the West. But, you know, creating the infrastructure necessary to charge these vehicles, will alleviate a lot of the concerns that people have about, moving from traditional gas-fired, gas-powered automobiles. And this $7.5 billion portion of the spend over the next 5 years to get money out to build infrastructure for electric vehicle charging, I think, again, is a game changer. So short term, lots of spend, hopefully lots of jobs. Longer term, are we going to be seeing these new technologies bringing us major sea changes in the energy space? And of course, that's sort of the $1.2 trillion question.
That's a big dollar amount. You know, I hate to be the pessimist here, but, part of me is asking the question, we've always known that we need to invest more in infrastructure of, our entire country. Why now? Why is now the right time? Why is now going to be any different than before? And how is $1.2 trillion is going to solve the problem that, you know, frankly, we've been talking about for decades.
Ryan, I have some thoughts on that. I basically, you know, agree with Alan's tour through the bill and what it's trying to do. But the bill is a reminder that utility infrastructure, especially the most ubiquitous of the utility infrastructures, which is electric infrastructure, has always been extremely capital intensive. Yeah. I know $1.2 trillion sounds like a lot, but I bet if you aggregate the investment that's been made in energy and utility infrastructure over the past few decades, it's a whopping number. It's always been that way. And that's why one of the most ticklish issues with the whole undertaking is recovery of that capital. If you're investing capital, you want to make sure it's recovered. There's a return on that investment and it's fully depreciated. Well, guess what? Perhaps now more so than ever, the future path of what infrastructure is needed, what's the best infrastructure, what should be supported and encouraged and what should be discouraged is a little unclear. You know, take, for example, the EV electrification that Alan referred to. Well, that's great. It's certainly needed. We're going to sell a lot more EVs if we have an adequate recharging infrastructure across the U.S. But what if in 5 years, hydrogen and fuel cell vehicles start coming along and blow the doors off the EVs? You can't completely discount that risk. It's got to be measured and gauged somehow. And it sharpens the issue of knowing exactly, you know, where capital ought to flow into what. And that's why I think a lot of professionals become involved and engaged in this area to try to help the users of these services, particularly electricity, to discern what's the most prudent path forward. You know, where do I put, which basket do I put my eggs in? How quickly and how many? And that's the art of the whole thing, if you will.
Yeah, yeah. No, don't get me wrong. I'm very, very excited about the infrastructure bill. You know, ultimately, you know, we live, we breathe maintenance, reliability, operations in our business. And we often have this saying around just deferring maintenance until something completely breaks down. And then that's when you go say, all right, let's go invest the money because it's completely depreciated and we're in a big pickle. And part of me feels like, yeah, that's kind of the state-ish that we're in right now. We've been deferring maintenance. We've been deferring investment in our own infrastructure until one day we wake up and say, oh, crap, it's gotten pretty bad.
I want to also just point out, you know, under the $7.5 billion that's allocated in the infrastructure bill that we call sort of electric vehicles, a substantial portion of that is in theory available in grants for things like hydrogen and alternative fuels. And John's comments really do raise an interesting point, which is it's hard when you're crafting these kinds of major bills not to sort of implicitly be charged with picking winners and losers. And I think this bill is kind of did a nice job of trying to avoid that. The fact of the matter is, if we can get to a greener economy and a greener energy place generally, the benefits are so substantial, but there is no one way to get there. And the bill recognizes that, and having healthy competition in alternative ways, for example, even powering automobiles, there's room for hydrogen, there's room for traditional EVs, and there's room for other technologies that in theory could be developed with some of the resources that we're looking at spending that we can't even imagine right now. And I think that's exciting stuff. I think the important thing is to recognize that, you know, we're long past the point of relying on traditional fossil fuels for stuff like energy. And we have recognized as a country, we have deferred that maintenance, as you've said, on utility infrastructure for decades. I mean, without picking too many specific names, but certainly the California wildfires and the issues that utilities have had out there specifically related to the causation of issues caused by, you know, their own facilities or not being able to be resilient to address, you know, weather conditions out there. is all we need as a country to recognize that something has to be done. And the imperative is, as I said earlier, renewable facilities like wind and solar are not and can't be built in downtown San Francisco or New York City or Philadelphia or Chicago. And if you start building those kinds of facilities on the scale and scope that we've been doing, utility scale, massive types of facilities, you've got to find a way to build electric infrastructure transmission to move that someplace. Yeah. And that's going to take the dollars that we're talking about, the investment that's here, and hopefully the will of the people to allow these kinds of facilities to be built.
All right. Well, I am cautiously optimistic. Let's talk about another, I think, very timely current topic right now that's going on related to energy, the cost of energy, which is the skyrocketing price of gas. So some current events around the world, Germany heating's been turned down. In Peru, there's violent protests around the rising cost of fuel. In Nigeria, there's this national energy grid that completely collapsed. And we're only, 4 months into the year. So there's a lot going on. Obviously, you know, all of us talk about the rising cost of fuel here in the States. In California, it's like $7 a gallon. What's going on right now, and how, you know, how's all this going to play out in the future?
I think, Ryan, these recent events you've been describing are more or less reminders of something that's always been true. And that is availability of supply for your energy needs and consistent and fairly stable pricing have been the hallmarks of what every energy user really wants and needs. We mentioned a moment ago the Three Mile Island accident. In the late 1970s, that was a perfect example of unexpected volatility that had to be dealt with. General Public Utility suddenly found half its baseload electric generation unusable because of a completely unexpected accident. It had to regroup, get Alan Seltzer busy on a lot of long-term purchase power agreements to backfill for this electricity generation that suddenly disappeared on them. Guarding and being prepared for crisis volatility, crisis-driven volatility, unexpected shortages, changes in inflation rates that suddenly spike up prices. All of those are sort of lumps in the price and availability of energy that people have to constantly work at to avoid. And seizing on the point you made about putting some kind of facility together and then not worrying about it for 20 years, you can't do that. You have to have a team of folks that are constantly looking at what should we be ready for? How long-term is our current energy supply? How long is our facility going to last? How many outages are we going to have in whatever we've constructed that we need to cope with to make sure that we have adequate replacements? No one likes their prices to move around. No one likes to have to worry about availability of your energy supply. So, putting yourself in a position where you have insurance that those kinds of risks have been hedged. It's one of the reasons that since the 1970s, energy users have been moving towards getting more control over the availability of their energy, and the cost of that energy has been sort of a steady goal of folks. That's why people build chip facilities, natural gas powered facilities that can generate an electricity supply that has a stable price, whose maintenance they can control, whose planning for outages they can control, is preferable to being dependent on a grid that's maintained by another entity. And the cost of the electricity delivered over that grid can vary from month to month, year to year, decade to decade. Consistency of price and supply are the golden standard that people want to pay attention to and take care of. One of the recent keeping in mind your audience, something that we've come across recently is a is a CHIP, a combined heat power facility developer, who's getting keenly interested in reducing outages. In other words, you schedule outages. You know, if you have a CHIP facility, there are going to be certain times in the year when maintenance is required, and you're going to go down. That's why you have a backup electricity supply from the local utility arranged ahead of time. Well, they've been thinking about where their facilities that they've designed and installed are, where their maintenance resources are, and they're beginning to stage all this so they have adequate personnel proximate to their customers, so they can continue to reduce both scheduled and unscheduled outages. Get their people right on the location of the customers. Work with troubleshooting and preventative maintenance to reduce the number of outages they have. It's all towards the goal of making that CHIP facility have a higher efficiency rating and work more days and hours of the year than you thought was possible. And this is all to the benefit of the customer. Just an example.
So we've talked a lot about, you know, essentially the rising cost of fuel. We've talked about, you know, everything from the infrastructure bill, deferred maintenance. I kind of want to ask the question, if you have any thoughts around like how it ultimately affects our listeners, the maintenance reliability men and women that support sustain our world. You know, we've got this tremendous amount of money that's getting poured into infrastructure. We've got this energy crisis going on right now, but, you know, ultimately it's a lot of it is going to be supported, hopefully, by, you know, the future investments that we make in our own infrastructure, in, you know, renewables. You know, we talked a little bit about job growth. I'd be curious, like, how do you feel like it might affect, you know, ultimately the normal maintenance, reliability, operations person, someone that works in manufacturing, someone that works in maintenance? How do you think that all of this affects them over the next 3, 5, 10 years?
Ryan, folks that are servicing infrastructure and equipment and facilities, either existing or new, are going to be in substantial demand over the next 15 or 20 years. I mean, if we've learned anything over the last decade or more, is that deferred maintenance, not really being on the cutting edge of innovation and trying to deliver energy in a safe, reliable, and cost-effective manner is a fool's game. No one wins. Customers lose, and everybody loses when we are vulnerable to outages, effects of weather, cybersecurity, physical issues, or the normal effects of deferred maintenance. Regardless of whether it's new investment, checking at developing new technologies, or preserving good quality equipment that we have right now, those folks that are in the maintenance and support services group will always be incredibly valuable. The hope is that company managements that are responsible for the ownership and operation of these key energy assets, you know, place the right value both on the equipment and their maintenance to be able to provide the kind of efficient service and reliable service that we want. I mean, when you have inefficient equipment, when you have stuff that has not been maintained properly or is essentially functionally obsolete, you're raising costs for everyone. And that's not the preferred outcome. I mean, regardless of whether you're your utility consumer or the manager of a company that operates this type of thing, these types of equipment, that doesn't serve anybody's long-term economic interest to basically having facilities and equipment that are not properly maintained and are not replaced. And I think, if anything, utilities, as well as others that are in this space, it has been too easy for many years to defer these kinds of maintenance for fear that they're not going to be able to recover their capital investment or even their O&M operation and maintenance expenses. From a purely regulatory perspective, those costs need to be covered. And then from the entrepreneurial, non-regulated world, there have to be clear incentives for folks to make the kind of spend needed to preserve reliable and efficient equipment, recognizing that the upfront cost pales to the back end capital cost if stuff has to be replaced prematurely because we've allowed it to essentially degrade and become functionally obsolete.
What I really hear from you in that statement is ultimately like the boots on the ground, maintenance, operations, reliability, you know, managers, technicians, these roles are going to be in increasingly high demand. And we often talk about, especially on this podcast, this labor shortage of what's you know, going on even within these roles. $1.2 trillion is a lot of money. I think we've learned that, especially over the last 2 years, when the government pours that much money into businesses and infrastructure, like it has a real impact on our jobs and, you know, this industry as a whole. So I think ultimately it's a positive thing. I think that it is going to help propel our industry, but, you know, ultimately there still are a ton of challenges ahead of us. You know, the first thing being, you know, yes, there's going to be increasingly high demand of these jobs, but do we even have enough people to support it?
Or do they have the skill set, and do we have educational support
exactly.
to teach these folks what's needed? You know, the blessing and the curse of, you know, renewable energy and other projects and technologies that are developed with all the spend that the infrastructure bill has is, do we have the support services necessary, you know, to basically help out on the cutting edge stuff that's likely to be developed? And that means, you know, educational opportunities, getting the word out to young people that there is a whole different set of skills that may be needed in the next 15 or 20 or 30 years than we might have seen in the past.
I hope there's support for those kinds of efforts in the bill. You know, the utility industry's been noticing a declining pool of folks available to take their positions. And Alan and I have had clients that have invested in junior college training programs that produce electric linemen that can proceed directly to very, very high paying, fulfilling jobs in the utility industry. But the utility industry has had to try to prime that pump itself. And if the government could help on that front, I think it would be a wonderful thing.
Well, thank you both for sharing so much amazing knowledge around this topic. You know, what we always do is kind of end the show with a few quick fire set of questions to leave our audience with a few extra nuggets of information. You ready to jump in? So it's basically a quick fire. I'll ask a short statement, get you guys' thoughts in 20 seconds or less. All right, the first one I've got for you is, what's your contrarian view? What's something that you believe in that most people may not agree with? John?
I would say it's the value of costs that a lot of customers and clients are concerned about and try to avoid, which are the soft costs. In other words, everybody's trying to drive down their soft costs in a given utility or energy project. What Alan and I have seen from real life experience is that folks who don't put the right team together of economic, engineering, and legal consultants to discern what their true status quo is and what their direction forward might be, often end up wasting money rather than saving money by avoiding that kind of upfront legwork.
Alan?
Yeah, I think for me is trying to convince people, particularly industrial and large companies that are, whose business is not directly related to energy, that they can take much better control of their costs, operations, and businesses by owning their own generation and using that as the support for their business operations. It's a very scary thing if you're in the widget making business to say, wait a minute, I don't want to really get into energy supply and operating a power plant or a combined heat and power facility. But we have been able to work with folks and demonstrate to people that if you are willing to take a look at that, you have a lot more control over the very things John was talking about earlier: certainty, predictability, avoidance of volatility in the energy market. Lots of folks are adverse to doing that, and they are adverse for all the wrong reasons. And we like to spend a lot of time telling people there is another way, and we think we can help you.
All right, I agree with that, even though this is the contrarian view. All right, so if you could go back, John and Alan, if you could go back and give yourself, you know, your 18-year-old self one piece of advice, what would that be?
Well, I think for me, Ryan, it would be probably work a little bit less, work a little bit more efficiently, have that work-life balance, which was never a term that was within my generation's lexicon when we were starting out. I look back on my career and my life over the last 44 years of practice, and it's been a great one. And I enjoy every moment of it and still do. But I love the fact that, you know, people today, you know, seem to have arrived at a better balance of work and life. I think if I, as an 18-year-old, I could have understood that better as I was just, you know, finishing up law school and beginning to embark on my law career, I might have been a little bit happier along the way.
And I would say, Ryan, buy Apple stock with every dollar I could scrape together as soon as it was available. And then, you know, have confidence in what my study of an issue seemed to indicate was its future direction and act on it. In other words, there's a tendency for folks to kind of lay back until there's, you know, sort of a block of momentum behind a particular view or stance on an issue. And, you know, sometimes you can see the flaws in that, and having the confidence to act on that and pursue it, at an early stage is important and something I wish I'd done more of.
I completely agree. I mean, I was talking about this yesterday with one of our teammates here at Upkeep, but oftentimes there's this indecision, you know, analysis paralysis.
Yep.
But I think what oftentimes people forget is not making a decision is oftentimes making a decision.
Right.
And it's oftentimes not the right. best one, you know, most of the time.
I agree.
All right. What's the biggest takeaway that you hope all of our listeners are going to learn from and take away from today?
I would say, you know, beware of consultants that approach you with a preset solution to your needs, and don't take the time and effort to really understand what your status quo situation is and where you may want to move. If all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And I think you need to sort out when you do your due diligence on something important to your company in the energy utility area, that you get the right team together right from the get-go that will be objective. And not try to sell you on a predetermined solution that may not fit.
I think, Ryan, for me, at a little bit more global perspective, the energy world is complex. And it's very easy, given the things we've talked about today and others we haven't talked about, to find yourself in a world in which you either want to give up or constantly being reactive. And what I would want listeners and folks that have heard this conversation today to take away is, in the face of climate change, in the face of all the issues that we face globally that impact energy supply and weather change and all those kinds of impacts, we need to continue to be proactive. And it's individual by individual, company by company, business by business. We're strong proponents of what we call distributed generation. People, you know, getting away from central station power sources, doing more that they can do on their own business and their own property to meet their energy needs, to help build the kind of resilience and reliability that perhaps the electric grid and other energy sources haven't been able to do, and to continue to recognize that we're in this together, and as complex as it is in trying to deal with all the political and energy issues that impact us in this space, we can't give up. We can't afford to give up, and that we owe it to our kids and our grandchildren not to.
John, Alan, really appreciate you guys taking the time. Such an interesting conversation that I've personally learned a ton from. You know, I would love to follow you guys on your journey, and I'm sure all of our listeners would as well. How can they connect with you and follow you?
www.bipc.com. Our whole careers are laid out on that website.
And I might also say, you know, we have our own podcast that we've talked about. It's called Alternative Power Plays. It's available at any place that folks get and get their podcasts, Apple Podcasts and Spotify and so forth. It provides sort of a supplement to some of the things that you have done superbly with with your podcast. And I think they really kind of work hand in hand. And we certainly would ask and direct any of your folks to check that out as well.
Awesome. Thank you again, John and Alan, for joining us. Thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in to today's episode of the Maintenance Mavericks podcast. Again, my name is Ryan. I'm the CEO and founder of Upkeep. You can connect with me on LinkedIn. Shoot me an email directly at ryan@upkeep.com. I hope everyone enjoyed today's conversation. I personally learned a ton. I really mean it, Alan and John. I look forward to connecting with everyone soon. Until next time, thanks again.
Thank you, Ryan.
Thanks, Ryan. Great stuff.